From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show tonight. Later on, Joshua P. Warren with his paranormal moment. But here's what's happening. Federal health officials raising the death toll to 18 now in an outbreak of listeria in Cantaloupe. This story just doesn't go away. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that they have confirmed now 100 illnesses in 20 states, and that includes the 18 deaths. The agency said it has confirmed two additional deaths in Colorado and one in Kansas since last week. The death toll may continue to rise. Wyoming may have another death on its hands. Jensen Farms in Holly, Colorado, recalled its cantaloupes on September 14th after the farm's melons were traced to the listeria illness. Delta Airlines saying federal officials arrested a man who became disruptive on a flight from Amsterdam to Detroit. The man was quickly restrained and was taken into custody by officials waiting when the flight landed at Detroit's Metropolitan Airport. Flight 235 continued on to Detroit without further issue after the man was restrained. A statement describes that the man was disruptive, might have been drunk. Doesn't say how he was restrained or who restrained him on the plane. Syrian's President Bashar Assad is warning that he will set the Middle East on fire if NATO forces attack his country. Assad also reiterated that Damascus will call on Hezbollah in Lebanon to launch an intensive rocket and missile attack on Israel if his country is attacked. Europe has a debt crisis. America has a job crisis. Corporate profits, some in trouble, and world financial markets in turmoil. And no one seems prepared to ride to the rescue. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke bluntly warned Congress of what most of us have sensed for some time. The economy recovery is faltering. Greg Hunter, USAWatchdog.com, he's with us. How bad's it faltering, Greg?
Well, there's been some good numbers with automotive and stuff like that. But, you know, listen, we have no plan. We had a plan in Libya to knock out Gaddafi. We had a plan. We have a plan for health care, whether you like it or not, to ensure Americans. We have no plan. And he had all these contradictions in his testimony today. One minute he says there's been significant, improvement in banking, and yet, you know, three big banks were downgraded. Then he says the economy's faltering. And then he says the plan is, well, hey, listen, the most important thing that we could do, a crucial objective, is for for Congress, this new super committee, to get together by the end of next month and cut $1.5 trillion. This is a crucial objective. Well, you know, Congress has almost shut the government down, several times this year alone. And if this is a crucial objective, it ain't going to happen. They're deadlocked. And so my conclusion after watching the coverage today and reading all the testimony and reading his prepared remarks, there's no plan. If his plan is to get Congress to get together to cut $1.5 trillion in the next 10 years, and incidentally, that's not a cut. That just slows the growth of government spending. That's not a plan, and hope and optimism is not a plan for recovery.
And Greg, why in the world did the stock market rally toward the end of the day after all this was going on?
Here's why. Because the folks over in the EU, as reported by one of the foreign press overseas, that the EU was going to, quote, recapitalize the bank. And what hit me was, recapitalize. What are they going to do? Are they going to go to a recapitalization tree? Are they going to go to the recapitalization cave and load up? Are they going to scoop capital out of the ocean? They're going to how? Where's the money coming? They're going to print it. And that's how they're recapitalizing the banks.
Just like us. Greg, thanks so much. USAWatchdog.com. Mega wealthy Chinese investors are being given the chance to buy solid gold from the country's first gold vending machine. I kid you not, the machine, guarded round the clock by security guards, can dispense everything from a 2-kilogram ingot to a metal or trinket weighing a few ounces. Payment scanners recognize every Chinese banknote, and of course, credit gold cards, they say, are welcome, and the bankers are behind the machine. Fair-skinned people who are prone to sunburn may need to take supplements to ensure that they get enough vitamin D. It appears that those with pale skin while not deficient, may still be lacking in the essential vitamin that the body makes from sunlight. Europe is to lead the most ambitious space mission ever undertaken to study the behavior of our sun. Known as Solar Orbiter, the probe will have to operate a mere 28 million miles from the sun, closer than any spacecraft to date. A Delaware mother, along with a Philadelphia man, are facing charges after investigators allege the two agreed to sell the woman's newborn baby son. They wanted $15,000. Apple has unveiled an iPhone 4S, a faster version of its best-selling smartphone that includes a virtual personal assistant that you can talk to. The next-generation iPhone also will be available on Sprint's wireless network now for the first time, in addition to AT&T and Verizon. A model with 16 GB of storage starts at $200 with a two-year contract, and the 64 GB costs $400. Up next, we're going to talk about you. Did you go through school? Did you have a difficult time finding a job? Are you in college now? What are you thinking about your future? We're going to be talking with Michael Ellsberg, author of The Education of Millionaires, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We've got Michael Ellsberg for a couple hours tonight, split show. And later on, we're going to talk with him about his other work called The Power of Eye Contact. Incredible work. Michael Ellsberg was born in San Francisco in 1977, grew up in Berkeley, graduated from Brown University in 1999 with honors. He is the author of numerous books, including major developmental work on his father, Daniel Ellsberg's bestseller, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. Michael also writes a blog on Forbes.com. Michael, welcome back. How are you?
It is great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
How's your dad doing, by the way? All well?
He's doing fantastic. This was his 80th birthday this year. And last year, the documentary about him called The Most Dangerous Man in America was nominated for Best Documentary and was one of the five that was possibly going to win at the Oscars, although the Dolphin movie won instead.
Well, I said it before, Michael, I'll say it again. He's an American hero doing what he did back during the Vietnam era when nobody would be a whistleblower. He came forward, released those papers under incredible duress. Of course, as you know, and, you know, highly proven, you know, how much we were lied to by government.
That's absolutely right. And I wasn't around at that era. I'm 34 right now, but I absolutely agree with you. And he's my hero as well. And I have very fond memories of being on this show with him and with another co-author of mine 3.5 years ago.
That's right. That's right. We had a great time there. Well, you've done two great things. So we're going to later on, we'll talk about the power of eye contact. But you've talked about the education of millionaires. And as we look at what's going on now in this country, where universities are continuing to pump out these kids with degrees and the economy just can't keep up. It can't even employ people who've got years of experience, Michael. What are these kids going to do?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know exactly. If you're coming out of college right now and you've got the average debt is $25,000, which is a lot of debt for a 22-year-old. But let's say you got 25. Some kids have now $100,000 in debt.
Jeez.
And you've got this credential that is essentially the same as everyone else. So you have kids with $100,000 of debt now who are working $10, $15 an hour jobs as assistants. And that's the only kind of debt in the country that cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. So it's extremely dangerous form of debt to be playing with.
You know, my daughter's paying down her college, and of course I'm helping her do that. It's tough. She's got more going out than coming in right now.
Yeah, it's very scary. I think the college can potentially make sense if you want to be a lawyer, a doctor, some kind of traditional professional, although even now it's extremely hard to get a job in the legal field, and a lot of the lawyers are having trouble getting employment as well. But in those cases, I think it does make sense. But if you're like me, where you're going into college and you're wondering what the heck you're going to do with your life, as I was when I went to college, you know, 50 grand a year is a very expensive way to figure out what you're going to do with your life.
It sure is. Now, you call your latest work The Education of Millionaires. It's not what you think, and it's not too late. Tell me about that title, Michael.
So I spent the last 2 years interviewing people who dropped out of school, of college, or who didn't even go to college in the first place, and who later went on to become self-made millionaires and even a few billionaires. So what I'm really talking about is the distinction between schooling and education. These people didn't have a whole lot of schooling, or at least they didn't complete their schooling, but it's wrong to say that they didn't have an education. They actually had a very powerful education. It just happened that that education came while they were earning money instead of spending money, by building businesses, by getting work experience, starting young. So the book is really, as it says, the education of millionaires. How did these people go from nothing and often starting, you know, in quite poverty and educate themselves to be not only wealthy but to be creators of jobs, to be giving economic opportunity to other people?
How did you get to these people? Most of them have secretaries.
Great question. So one of the skills that I talk about as being crucial for your success is learning how to network and connect. And you know, if you don't, let's put it this way, if you have a degree but you don't know how learn how to be a good connector and networker, economic opportunity is going to be tough to come by in life. Whereas if you don't have a degree but you do learn to become a fantastic networker, then all the economic doors you could want open up for you. So I just took my own medicine here and learned how to network well. And knew very few of these people beforehand, but over 2 years was, if you look at the cover of the Forbes 400, for example, this month has a guy called Sean Parker on there. I interviewed him. I actually just spent a week with him, helping him with a project he's launching right now. And I didn't know him before this book. So it's all about connecting. It's all about networking.
What are the age ranges of these millionaires and billionaires, Michael?
So the youngest ones are in their mid-20s, and in fact, I interview a guy called Dustin Moskovitz, who is currently the world's youngest self-made billionaire. I think there may be one or two billionaires who are younger but who inherited their money, but he's the youngest who actually earned his money himself.
What did he do?
And he was the co-founder of Facebook.
Ah, okay.
He was in the dorm room there with Mark Zuckerberg.
Okay, and that's the name everybody remembers.
Yeah, that's right. And so so they dropped out of Harvard, and now he's built up Facebook and now is doing his next venture. So a lot of them are in their 20s, and that's a really interesting thing because, you know, I sound like a old man talking, you know, when I was a kid.
Yeah, you're 34, right?
But actually, so this is actually a difference between when I was in my 20s and what's happening now with young people in their 20s. When I was in my 20s, it was before the internet, really, or the internet had basically just started, and there wasn't really an easy way to start a business without a brick-and-mortar storefront. So starting a business was an extremely capital-intensive, risky proposition where if you failed, you could be on the hook for quite a bit of debt. Now, to start a business, it costs $10 to register a domain name and $5 a month of domain of hosting. And so you have kids across the world starting businesses in a way that is completely unprecedented in the history of humanity, really, and that didn't exist even 15 years ago when I was that age.
I know some people in St. Louis, they're in their 20s, Michael, and they're doing exactly what you just said. Some of them have like five or six little businesses, all of them selling little products over the internet. But these are things that you could never do before the internet at all. And I would guess you would never have 20-year-old billionaires back in the 1920s, would you?
No, virtually impossible. Certainly not self-made billionaires, because to get that wealthy requires doing business globally. And there just wasn't any way to do business globally from literally your bedroom or your dorm room before the internet. Maybe you could do it with a catalog on the phone, and probably a few people did that. But really now, I meet 15-year-olds, and I'm astonished at the things they're doing. I mean, they're communicating with people all over the world. They're creating projects all over the world. And this is the world we live in now, where you just get hop on the internet, and there's all this opportunity, and there's all these ways you can connect and start things and start organizations and start businesses. And my argument is that is a very different world than the world in which we formed a lot of our traditional notions about how to get educated. And I think that it's time that our notions about education updated to fit the updated world that we live in.
Over the weekend, the king of infomercials killed himself, Don LaPree. And I used to remember watching him years ago on television. He was a young kid at the time. You know, he'd go on the air, and he was the one who would say, "You can put little classified ads in the newspaper and make $50,000.
Yeah.
And I found him to be fascinating just watching what he did. Something obviously backfired on this guy.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. I actually haven't heard of him, and I don't know the particulars, but it's always, you know, very troubling when you hear someone in that situation. But that probably goes to show, and again, I don't know the particulars of his case, that it's really not just about money. I mean, my assumption is this guy probably made a lot of money in his life.
Yeah.
And look, I'm not here to knock money. I mean, my book is called The Education of Millionaires, and, you know, money brings a lot of benefits in your life when and if you get it. But it's really, it is a cliche, but it's just true. It's not the only thing. And there's many, many, many wealthy people who are miserable. So we have to have a more holistic definition of success that's not just about money.
I think you need to be a happy person first before you make money. If you haven't been able to do that in your life, money's not going to make you happy. If anything, like you said, it makes you more miserable.
Yeah. You know, I just saw a tweet by a blogger that I follow a lot, a guy called James Altucher, and he's a successful venture capitalist and hedge fund manager who's one of the most outspoken voices critical of higher education today. And he had a tweet called, "Money doesn't solve all your problems, but it solves your money problems."
Money that's true.
All your problems, but it solves your money problems. And that sounds like a joke. I actually think it's quite wise. It's you know, people have all kinds of problems. They have health problems, love problems, you know, existential, philosophical, religious, spiritual problems. Money rarely solves those. It can solve health problems sometimes, but what it does solve is when you have money problems. So that is a good reason enough to at least pay attention to it and not ignore it.
A kid who's 25 right now, a younger person, I call them a kid. At my age, they're kids. Somebody who's 25 years old, whether or not they're in college or graduating or have graduated, in this economy today, what do you recommend they do? What should they be looking for in order to protect themselves?
So a lot of people are saying, if you don't go to school, that means you have to go to vocational school. And I think that's the wrong answer, because vocational school, as opposed to liberal arts education, teaches you how to prepare for a certain career, and those careers might not exist in 5 years. Things are changing so quickly that the technology you learn today literally may be irrelevant and obsolete by the time you graduate. So I think the answer is not necessarily vocational school. So what is the answer then? And I think it is learning a set of universal skills that will be useful to you in any economic circumstance. And some of the key ones that I believe are extremely important are, we've already mentioned, learning how to network. That will serve you well any economic circumstance, any country you're in, any industry you're in. Another one is learning about sales. If you learn how to sell well, you will never be short of economic opportunity. And that is not just selling products and services. It's also selling your own ideas, selling yourself, say, in a job interview. That's a form of sales. Most people don't learn it very well, and that's why they have trouble getting jobs.
That's true. I went to the University of Detroit, Michael. I got a degree in broadcasting. I'm not sure the degree ever got me a job, but I think what the 4 years of college did for me is it taught me and it honed some skills that I'm not sure I would have gotten just on the street, which I did pick up later on in life as well, but I think it gave me some additional skills.
Sure. Which ones? I have no doubt of that. Which ones do you think in particular?
Speech, primarily. It gave me the ability, I think, to talk before a public forum and not be nervous and shaky and everything else. And I think that had a dramatic effect on my performance as I got into radio and television at a younger age. It really kind of just calmed me down And I would probably do it again, not necessarily for the degree, but for the experience of the school. Michael, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back and talk more with you about your work, the education of millionaires. And later on, we'll talk about the power of eye contact. What a story he has written here. And then next hour, we'll take phone calls with him. Michael Ellsberg, our guest, Split Show on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, every month for a year, I'm going to ask 1,000 of you to reach into your pockets or your purse and pull out a quarter every day. That's it. 1,000 of you once a month for a year, a quarter every day. Why? Because I want you to become a Coast Insider and get downloads and podcasting. You can download 1,000 past shows and keep them as a library and a little chip and have some fun with that. So that's what I'm going to do. Now, you may ask, how do I do this? Well, you simply go to coasttocoastam.com. Up there in the right-hand corner, click the Coast Insider little verbiage and take it away. Simple as that. I think one of the tricks of all this too, Michael, I think people need to find a comfort level, a happiness level, regardless of what their income stream is, and try to be happy with that. I know it's not easy in this day and age, you know, whether you have a poor relationship or a job you're not happy with, but somehow people need to find that happiness factor first, don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's not just about money. And in some ways, a little secret is I made the title about money because that's what most people pay attention to. And if you start talking about other things, they don't pay quite as much attention at first. But once I have their attention, you know, I want to talk about a broader sense of success. And it's the whole picture. It's relationships, it's health, it's sense of spirituality, whatever that may mean for you. It's a sense of vision, meaning, and purpose. And all these things come together to create a sense of a successful life. And so it's really not just about money. And one thing that I find sad, though, is that if you look at what we encourage our young people to be doing between, say, the ages of around 8 or so and 22, it's almost all this intense stress about getting grades, SAT scores, and getting kids into the best college possible. And if you look, they've done studies, which I could probably look up and get references to, but I've definitely read about it, where they look at kids' grades and also like which college they got into. And in the end, it really doesn't have a huge impact. Once you're past the middle level, like once you're past, say, a B and you get into an okay college, after that, you know, other things have much, much more impact on how much money you earn, that's how right. happy you're going to be in your life, how healthy you're going to be. All those things are much more important than our focus on this intense focus on grades and test scores.
Well, the old days, you know, an MBA meant solid, you know, revenue, a good increase, a good job. Is that still the case, Michael?
So here's an interesting shift that's happened in our society. So most of our current views about education were formed by my parents' generation or people my age, their parents who were going to school in the 50s and 60s. And at that time, there weren't that many people who had BAs. So if you had a BA, it really set you apart, and it meant that you were something hot and special and employers really wanted you. Now everyone has a BA. I'm pretty sure the guy who poured me my coffee this morning, if I asked him, probably had a BA. So it doesn't set you apart at all, really. And yet, at the same time, so the advantage it gives you has gone a lot down. And at the same time, it's gone insanely more expensive. In college in the 50s and 60s, I've read about, costs a couple hundred bucks a year. And even with insane inflation that's happened since then, that's not a lot of money back then for college. Whereas now it's gone up, you know, hundreds of times in real terms. And now you're looking at $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. It's a crazy system, and it can't last, and it's not going to last.
How important is experience, Michael? Dave Thomas, the late Dave Thomas, who was the creator of the Wendy's franchise, used to work as a chef at a restaurant at a series of fast food restaurants that ultimately picked up and bought some Kentucky Fried Chicken franchises. And he worked with the Colonel. You know, he gave him recipes. He taught him stuff. He convinced the Colonel to do television commercials because he said, you're the most credible one here for the company. He took what he learned on the street and turned it into a multi-billion dollar enterprise.
Absolutely. Experience is everything. I just hired an assistant for the first time today, literally today. It was my first time working with her, first employee I've ever had. And I didn't care squat about what was on her resume, what was, all the clubs she was in school. She is a college graduate. I wanted to know, I just wanted to see, do you know how to write a decent email? Can you spell? Can you write grammatically correct emails that are polite
right.
and have tact? And you don't learn that in school. You learn it by doing it and by making mistakes and by having people correct those mistakes. And that's called experience. And ideally, you get that early on, and then you know your employer doesn't want to give you that experience necessarily. I mean, I'm hiring this woman because she already has that experience. So all of us need to be getting experience as quickly as possible in the field that we want to work in. And unfortunately, our education system is this delayed growing up. It's a prolonged adolescence. And I was part of this, by the way, too. I'm not accepting myself here from this. I was absolutely part of it, where we kids we're not really growing up until late 20s, early 30s, and it's crazy. It's completely crazy.
When an 18-year-old graduates from high school, elects not to go to college, what are the odds of that person getting a job?
So this is a very important question. So people look at these statistics. They say that you know, if you don't have a college degree, you have lower chances of getting a job, which is statistically true. However, and this is a big however, if you have a lot of motivation, that changes things. If you know how to learn, if you know sales, that changes things. If you're highly, highly ambitious, that changes things. If you want to start a business instead of rising up through the corporate ranks, that changes things. So there's a lot of ways out of that statistic. That statistic is not a death sentence to be flipping burgers at a fast food joint for the rest of your life.
Would you go to college today? You went to Brown University, graduated in 99. What would you do?
No, I would not. And I didn't even get the worst situation here in that I graduated with very little student debt. I was very fortunate. My uncle wanted me to go, and he made it possible for me to go. So I didn't even have the worst situation of the young kids you see now who are graduating with $100,000 of debt. Even still, I feel that it was 4 years that I could have been getting work experience, and it took me that much longer to start getting on my own 2 feet. I really didn't get on my own feet learning about how to make a living, how to make my way in the world, until my late 20s, which is quite common these days. 50% of people in their 20s move back with their parents at some point in their 20s, and I was one of those 50%. I moved back in my parents' basement between, I think it was 25 and 27.
How did you feel when you did that? Did you feel as if you had failed?
Yes, I felt like a complete loser. And the reason that that happened was that, and I'm not trying to blame anyone else here. This was my decision. I bought in to a system which told me that I needed to go through this highly academic track in order to make my way in the world. I bought into it, hook, line, and sinker, and then I got out of that system, and I found I had no idea how to make my way in the world, no economically valuable, marketable skills. I didn't even know how to market my skills. None of that was taught to me. And again, I'm not trying to blame someone else here, but I'm saying it's a system that just isn't working for people, and it didn't work for me in my 20s.
Do schools put quotas on the types of applicants they accept? And what I mean by that, Michael, is let's say somebody wants to be a teacher, and they want to go to college and get a teacher's degree. Does the school say, well, historically now only 18% of graduates get jobs teaching based on the way things are right now? Therefore, we're going to limit the amount of kids in this kind of curriculum. Do they do that, or do they take them all in?
It depends. There's a lot of different types of schools. So there's most of the nation's higher education system is fairly unselective, and they'll take pretty much anyone who will open their checkbook. I went to Brown University, which is one of the more selective schools, and they and those kind of schools tend to look for a diversity of racial diversity, gender diversity, geographical diversity of interests. They want the kind of egghead nerds. They want the more like artsy hipster kids. They want a range of things. But one type of person that they don't tend to be very good at attracting is entrepreneurs, is people who are going to go and create businesses and create employment for everyone else. And the reason they're not good at attracting those people is because those people are already earning money. I mean, I just spent the last 2 years talking to these people, and you've got 18-year-old kids now. I mean, I've met 22-year-old kids who are starting real businesses. I'm not talking about scam, you know, get rich quick things.
Sure.
Real businesses with employees who are earning, who have, you know, millions of dollars in revenue and are earning hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
That's amazing. Is it all internet based primarily?
Yeah, it's definitely internet enabled. It's not that a lot of these are internet based info product type businesses where they're selling informational tools over the internet. But there's also businesses that are very much have a real, you know, flesh and blood component to them. And, you know, those kids, they look at the, what's on offer in our higher education system, and they say, you know, why do I need that? If I want to go read a book, I can just go and buy a book and read it. I don't need to be taking time off from my work to go sit in some classroom to do it. I'll just do it. There's a nice tree in the park. I'll just sit under the tree in the park and read. You know, what is wrong with that? I don't see anything wrong with that, except all our politicians think that that's somehow an abomination if a kid does that.
Michael, give us a glimpse into the future 3 to 5 years from now. What are we seeing?
I believe that we are, with regards to education, roughly where the internet was in 1995. We are at the very, very tip of the iceberg of the change that's about to hit us. We're at the very crest of the wave. And, you know, right now, if you think about it, virtually every area of our economy has been massively transformed by technology. So manufacturing, transportation, obviously communications, media, electronics, everything, computing has
Huge.
Been massively, massively transformed. The one area that is almost identical to how it was 100 years ago is education. And that is changing very, very quickly. Right now, people are realizing how insanely inefficient the system is, and they're starting to bring education technology to disseminate education. And as that starts happening, the traditional monopolies of education, the selective universities and the kind of on-location campuses, are going to find themselves facing some very stiff competition from cheaper alternatives through online self-education.
What do you want people to take away from this book, The Education of Millionaires? What's the big message here?
I want people to take away the idea that they don't have to give away their power to some other educational institution. I believe very, very much in education. I think that education is the key to our success, my success, everyone's success. But I don't believe we have to give the keys to these super expensive, super elite, snobby institutions that are monopolizing education. I feel that we can all go out and get it for ourselves inexpensively without going into debt, without taking time off from work, without going back to school, and get the education we need to succeed. And it's available to all of us, all around us, in the real world, inexpensively. That's my message.
Well, and let's hope they do. Where can people get this book? It's a great read.
The book's available at bookstores across the nation right now, independent bookstores, Barnes & Noble. It's on the online retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound online. If you go to my site, Ellsberg.com, E-L-L-S as in Sam, B-E-R-G.com, there's some links there. People can get the first chapter and the introduction, which is roughly 25% of the book, actually. It's a very long first chapter. They can get that for free on my site, Ellsberg.com.
Your dad must be proud of you, Michael.
He is. He isn't necessarily attuned to all these business issues. He's more interested in political stuff, but he sees how hard I've been working on this, and he says, I'm proud of you, son, which is good to hear from my dad. It feels really good. I've been working hard on it.
Well, it sure does. When we come back in a few moments, I want to talk with you about the power of eye contact. That's an incredible story. And we'll take phone calls as well with Michael Ellsberg. Perhaps you've gone through many of the things we've been talking about tonight. But you went to college. Are you a little hypocritical here?
So I am writing about I spent 2 years writing about people who didn't go to college. So I've probably talked to more people that didn't go to college and who became successful than anyone else on the planet. I'm the guy who knows the most about that at this point. And I think the fact that I went to college, I've kind of seen it both ways now. I've talked to all these people who didn't. In fact, the book was inspired by my wife, who dropped out of college her junior year and went on to become a very successful entrepreneur. So I've seen that side of it through talking to people, but I've also seen the traditional side. I went through the most traditional academic elite type of education you could imagine. So I've really seen it both ways. And I think that the education I gained in the real world in my 20s, once I got out of college, is infinitely more valuable to me than what I ever gained in any academic context.
If somebody wants to go back to school for an education, would you applaud that?
If they have a very specific thing they want to do with it. So if someone wants to become a teacher and they need to get a master's degree to get that credential, that makes sense. If someone wants to become a psychologist, a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, a other kind of professional, then it makes a lot of sense because you have to. I mean, you can't practice law without passing the bar, which, it helps a lot to have gone to law school to do that. If, however, so that's one case. The other case is where this is very common now, people are going back to get master's degrees for no particular reason, just that, hey, it kind of looks good on the resume.
Sure.
Most people have bachelor's, so let me stand out. Let me have a master's degree. I think that's a disastrous reason to go back and spend $100,000 in 2 years. I think that you can easily bootstrap your education and get all the benefit you'd get otherwise for much cheaper and much faster without having to leave the workforce.
Why is college so expensive?
That's a great question. So there's a number of reasons for it. One is an economic term you can look up called the cost disease of services. Cost disease of services. I don't know why they call it that, but that's what it's called. What it basically means is that when you have a service that requires a lot of labor, skilled labor to provide, and can't really be aided that much by technology, the cost of it shoots up astronomically compared to other areas where technology can really bring in efficiencies. So if you look at, the cost of electronic goods is dropping and dropping and dropping, and you get so much more for your money year after year after year, and that's because you get all these efficiencies with manufacturing. Whereas, the classic example is, it still takes four classical musicians to play a classical quartet, and you can't do it with three, and you can't do it with technology. So the price of classical music is going up. The price of healthcare with doctors is going up, and the price of having one-on-one attention with a professor is going up. That's one reason. Another reason is more malicious, and that is that a lot of these college administrators know damn well that their customers, and I call them customers, not students, their customers have access to a huge credit line. And it's the exact same thing that happened in the housing market.
Good point.
Where you had all these people who probably shouldn't have been purchasing homes relative to their income, who all of a sudden had access to insane amounts of credit with almost no background checks whatsoever. And so what happened? The demand shot up because there was all this liquidity and credit in the system, and the prices shot up. Well, there's an exact direct parallel in education where you have all these people who can just put the entire thing on the credit card essentially and get student loans, And the administrators know that, so they just keep jacking the prices up. And it's a very, very vicious and, I think, intentional dynamic that they've gotten into there.
Okay, up next on Coast to Coast AM with Michael Ellsberg, we'll take your phone calls, share your stories. We'll also talk about the power of eye contact. Have you ever looked at somebody and you just knew what that person was all about? We'll be back on Coast to Coast AM.